This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Over the past few months, we've been undertaking a series of walks through West Philadelphia neighborhoods adjacent to the University of Pennsylvania and adjacent to Drexel University. We've been doing so because we want to reflect on and understand what's at stake spatially and politically when private entities such as universities or business improvement districts guard public property. What voice does the community have in this process? Is the action on behalf of or undermining the state? So earlier this morning, on April 29th, 2016, one of us assumed the role of a guard. It was Caroline, who's here today, and she transposed a mental map of her walks through these different neighborhoods to Hamilton Village Green, which is on the campus of the University of Pennsylvania. And I suppose, Caroline, do you want to begin by explaining to us how you arrived at the map that you've spatialized, and also maybe what that experience was like?
Yeah, so I took a number of walks. I called a walking guard through the university, city, district policing services and had them walk me around the perimeter of their districts. And every time I did these walks, I carefully mapped them out afterwards to see the routes that I took. And we have a drawing here of that. And then we sort of went over them this morning and compiled them and did sort of a composite map of the area, and that's the shape that I walked on the Hamilton Green. So I went across on 40th Street, which is the street that Slot is on, and also this park, and over and then down either Wallace, which is the border of the district, or Lancaster Street, which is like a big commercial street, and then back across on 38th.
So what was the experience like to be taking on the role of the guard as opposed to having been the person who was guarded or who was being escorted previously?
Yeah, I felt kind of insecure as a guard at first, although I was realizing I also felt really insecure, or at least like analytical of myself while I was being guarded, sort of self-conscious. It felt like people were looking at me when I was walking with the walking guard. Like, I guess it's not a very common thing for people to call walking guards. And then once we moved off campus into the neighborhoods in West Philly, I felt like I was being analyzed, but from a different perspective, coming into a neighborhood that clearly was not mine. And there weren't very many people out on the streets, but a lot of them just sort of looked at me funny. But then when I was the guard, I guess I was sort of getting similar looks. But I guess the longer I did it, the less weird about it I felt.
So you felt that as the conceptual performance played itself out, you were internalizing more and more the role of the guard.
Yeah.
So Amy, do you want to tell us a little bit about the work that we were trying to explore through these activities? And how you see Dennis Oppenheim's guarded land mass of 1970 or guarded land area of also 1970 in relationship to what we've just done today?
Thank you, Aaron. I'm glad to have the opportunity to work with you and your class and the students. It's been really amazing. So we started with guarded land area, which was adjacent to a museum building, and it was kind of a little bit of a spontaneous decision that Dennis made to approach the director of the museum and ask if he could borrow a guard, and the director agreed. He gave the guard a floor plan of a gallery, which would be in his mind as his job to guard, and to take that plan and transpose it or transfer it to an adjacent property, a land belonging to the public but adjacent to the museum building. So his idea was more about the value of art. How do you assign value to works that are inside a museum versus outside? And it was, you know, a comment really on the world that he was involved with, which is a little different than our expanding the project. So when we came to Philly, we incorporated a different piece, Guarded Land Mass, where he hired a guard on his own, which we were kind of worked into our re-performance here. The idea of hiring a guard to guard a land area that doesn't belong to you. And this one in Wisconsin, it was someone owned, but basically considered not mapped or not owned. And what does that mean, and how does that relate to what might be happening in certain cities where the idea is to kind of corral certain neighborhoods, perhaps, not qualitatively as good or bad, because it's very hard to differentiate that, but what does that mean to guard an area that really doesn't, is not yours, or is what borders are we extending, and for whose benefit? So this project really was kind of a merging of the two ideas, the two projects that Dennis did, and kind of making it relevant for Philadelphia. It's really an exciting city and culturally active in many institutions. So we kind of used it as a thought machine. So I think that's exciting because it's along the lines of his work, but he wanted his work to have an impact, and not, it was dynamic, and I think we tried to find a way to do that here, and I think we were successful.
Asaf, do you want to join in? I know that in a way we've invited you to speak as an artist, but also from an artistic perspective. Right, Caroline's been speaking in a way as a student and as one who has now taken on the role of the guard. Amy is speaking from an archival and historical trajectory. I'm assuming in a way a curatorial voice. Lori here is speaking as a student in the class who was not assuming the role of the guard, but rather a more spectatorial role. I don't know, what are your thoughts?
First, I'm very excited to be this artist's voice here. And when we're talking about this, like, guarded land area work, I was fascinated by this, like, reenactment of a working pattern outside. It was, for me, almost as, and when I was thinking about it, it was almost the working pattern of the guard in the museum is that he's scribing his body involuntarily through work as kind of an outcome of this, like, post-industrial area. You know, within the industrial area, the machine and the body would have relationship, and the machine would affect the body. Here it's a different relationship, there is an unconscious inscription of a pattern. And then when that is inscribed through labor, and when it's reenacted outside, it's almost like a psychoanalytic process that this inscription that was unconscious becomes conscious and is manifested through form. And then the interesting thing for me was whose hand is drawing the form. And especially with the museum, it is the architecture of the museum. And in that sense, it's very interesting about which hand is drawing the form in the city plan of Philadelphia. Or what kind of, like, what are the conditions of possibility that create a form that embeds all these kind of, like, politics to it.
So, for instance, is the city determining the form? Is Caroline determining the form? Is the guard determining the form? Is that what you're thinking about? Anyway, that there's this palimpsest of voices that are all together constructing the form, influencing the form. Is that what you mean?
I think the form in the city, I think Caroline's pattern is one form, and the guard is another one. And I think there is a sort of like inductive rationality that from those kind of like singular patterns we could keep. There is kind of like not a rule, but a more general form. Like, because I think we're talking about perimeter, to find like the perimeter, but that derivates out of the use of space. And in that sense, this combination of form that is an outcome of the use implies its conditions of possibility.
That certain paths would be more used or more or direct, or show something about the lives of the people in the neighborhood, or
in the neighborhood, about the parcelation of neighborhoods, how the like, let's say, where are, what are the popular perimeters that guards are doing, and in that sense, we know the distribution of students, and in that sense, we could get a form, and that form embeds this kind of like ideology that created it. But this is so as an artist, the relationship between ideology and form is the main interest.
I see. Yeah. So even though it seems like a supposedly arbitrary or casual or maybe intentional, but simple movement pattern, in fact, it's embedded with all sorts of ideological and cultural meaning that we can read and interpret and analyze. That's what, in a way, is that it? Yeah. And so when we transpose that pattern, that ideological construction, or reflect symbolic articulation to the university campus, like, what new meanings does it take on? What happens in that transposition, in that transfer?
So for me, it's almost like psychoanalytic. It's like moving from unconscious to conscious.
We're making it legible.
Making it legible, pronouncing it, or repronouncing it. And there is something about, there is an indexicality that is almost like photography. It, you know, when students talk about photography, talk about it almost like as a ready-made, like bringing a visual possibility to the space of the image. And it's recreating this.
I see.
And especially in that sense, it cannot only be pronounced, but also when I think about Dennis's work, I don't know, for some reason I was writing it before, and I'm like, see, because it showed me the art today, now the polarity, both the drawing, first drawing of his daughter, and the last drawing of his father, there is something about this vantage point of view, this kind of like, I call it angelic eye or bird view, in order to see the relationship between form and land.
Do you know the piece he's talking about, polarities? He took the his daughter's first drawing when she was six, and his father's last drawing, actually, he found it on his desk the day after his father died, and he took the drawings and he transposed them onto a land area in Long Island, and he lit them with flares and photographed them from above, and that was in 72. That was called Polaris. So I just wanted to tell you. He saw the piece because it was in the museum in Philadelphia, and they did the slide installation with sound because it had...
So I wanted to go back to something that you were saying, Asaf, about the transposition somehow making legible the hegemonic or ideological... let's say movements that might otherwise not be noticed or acknowledged. And I suppose, like earlier today, to come back to our collective experience this morning, my sense was that that far from making, like, instead of making it legible and revealing the politics of guarding, the ideological kind of implications of our movements through other neighborhoods, in fact it didn't conceal, but it didn't necessarily function in that way. It didn't necessarily make it more legible. It actually blended in a campus that is constantly being guarded in different ways. It seemed just ordinary. It didn't seem exceptional. It didn't seem unusual. And far from, again, revealing the implications of guarding, it seemed to maybe cover over. I don't know what your experiences were.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly saw, as I was guarding, a number of other real guards, and that was sort of an odd confrontation, because it felt like they were a real guard and I was only acting as a guard, whereas when I saw just...
But they also didn't seem to acknowledge
right,
that you were guarding,
and
you didn't
do anything.
Seem
yeah.
to, in any ostensible way, acknowledge them. It seemed like you just were all conducting your business.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was your job. You each had a job, and you conducted, you performed that job, but there was no moment of conflict or even of acknowledgement.
Mm-hmm.
But we did make a point of having you look guard-like.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, Carolyn is a dancer. She has excellent posture. And we gave her a security shirt and trousers to wear. And
she's been studying, and she's been studying and observing.
Yes, yeah, so
guarding.
She really was on the.
She assumed the role. She assumed
yes,
the role.
She, really
she internalized the role.
Did in that in a very successful way. Well, that was one of the aspects of this morning that impressed me.
Mm-hmm. So you mean it's supposed that maybe illegibility or hermeticism might be a consequence of her having assumed the role of the guard. Having dressed as guard, appeared as guard, and thus it was received in a way as normal, in a landscape on the campus which is constantly guarded.
A number of times people, like, walked across the green as I was guarding, and they kind of just ignored me. I felt like they saw so many guards that they didn't see me as any different than any of the university police, or they just ignored me.
You mean in the sense that they conducted themselves with a certain privilege and that there are those that guard for them?
Yeah.
And yeah, and that's just, that's understood, that's expected mm-hmm. in a way, that there will be others that guard on their behalf.
Yeah, and I think that guards are so ubiquitous on our campus, even more so than other college campuses, that when we do see a guard, it's just, it's not out of the ordinary. Mm-hmm.
So how do we, I want to get back to Dennis Oppenheim's conceptual performance in 1970.
Yeah.
Which we've maybe not lost sight of, but we haven't been talking about as much in this conversation. So in that, in both of those works, the guard, perhaps it's an effect of the photographic documentation, perhaps it's an effect of documentation. The guard seems so not just visible, but so much so differentiated from the environment in which they're moving through. You know, it very much seems to be about the experience of the guard as they guard a supposedly empty or supposedly evidently barren land mass or land area. And in this case, I mean, in a way, I felt that Caroline was dwarfed or almost hyper-invisible rather than hyper-visible. Like in Oppenheim's 1970 attempts, performance, conceptual performances, the guards seem hyper-visible. And here it was, you know, she was dwarfed by a landscape of verticality and of expanse and of, you know, all sorts of activity. I don't know, Amy or Caroline or... I know, Asaf, you weren't there this morning, but I don't know if any of you had that experience or reading.
Well, the world is a lot different in 2016 than it was in 1972.
And Philly's a lot different than rural Wisconsin.
Yeah, so, but hopefully, I mean, have we taken that into account? Perhaps we didn't take that into account if what we're after is something more...
with verisimilitude,
Not spectacular, but something to have more of an effect. It's maybe we should have considered that. Or, I mean, I don't think so. I mean, we chose the piece of land. It's adjacent to Slott. Mm. We even had photographs... Mm. of the Slott building behind, which kind of links it in a little way to the original performance that used the building floor plan. So I think the site that we chose was a good one. I mean, there could have been other factors. We mentioned the weather wasn't as good as it could have been. And maybe there would have been more activity on a different day.
But the weather's in a way analogous to that gray that one sees in the photographic documentation of South Central Wisconsin, right? This kind of...
Yes.
Yeah, supposedly non-spectacular weather pattern, right? Just gray, a gray zone, a gray sky.
Yeah, but if more people had been out on the field, for example, it was that we might have had more opportunity for it to be impeded on by people who are out among their going about their daily route or sports or whatever they might be otherwise playing on that field. So there wasn't really very much
tension or conflict or intersection.
Yeah. You
know. So what do we make of barrenness? Can we talk a little bit about this? I mean, in Philadelphia in 2016. Asaf, did you want to jump in and say something?
Yeah, I want to jump in, please. Yeah. So actually, the interesting thing about archaeology is that it's transparent. It's internalized, and it's accepted as an evidence, which is pretty much the description of the performance. Everybody said, okay, everybody's doing their job. This is what we're supposed to do now. So we just, like, ignore it or just, like, keep on with what we're doing. So, in that sense, it's like straight into the ideological predisposition of Philadelphia 2016. In that sense, I think it's in a way successful. Also, I was listening to your very interesting conversation online about the New Orleans Museum performance. And it was a very interesting discussion about the relationship between the actual performance and what is the place of the documentation of the performance within the museum. And I think a lot of those, of the power for this kind of performance is the way it leaves a document. Again, I'm going back to... the works, the Dennis's work in the Art Institute, they're all kind of like private performances in outside in land, but they manifest themselves through the photographic documentation, which turns them into an experience or relationship between the viewer and work. The relationship does not necessarily constitute while the work is enacted. it has a latent implication, or a latent value in that sense.
Yeah, well, that's an important point. There was really no audience to those performances, and they were documented, and we did take care to do that today as best we could. And we had discussed at one point the difference between the idea of cartology and the idea of choreography. Did you want to, just for a minute, tell Carolyn
and Laurie
what our thoughts were on that? Aaron, that's interesting, isn't it? In terms of this conversation, I think it fits.
Yeah, I think it'd be great if Asaf wanted to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think in our conversation we were talking about it's kind of like what's happening in the city as a cartography. We're mapping routes, with getting forms, but who and the same question with ideology. Who is writing this map? Who is this like choreographer? You know, like Adam Smith. Like who the individual. What is the invisible hand of this choreographer that we map the move and then we reenact it almost as a choreography? There's a very small like a change of letters within the two words, and it's very similar, and it describes pretty well this kind of movement from mapping, gathering information that is generated by interior forces of, let's say, in Philadelphia, gentrification, and then this kind of like cartography turns into choreography and manifests itself in an aesthetic way that embeds all these conditions, but in the land or in the adjacent space, in order to it be visible, not from the perspective of the viewer or the perspective of the of the people in the city, but this like kind of like jumping up to the plan view, and in that sense, this plan view is what enables us to see the whole choreography or to depict a perimeter, or when we talk about like threshold that is both physical and psychological, this perpendicular point of view enables us to grasp it.
Thank you.
I wanted to talk briefly with all of you about documentation from another perspective. Amy and I had been thinking in the last few days about Dennis's remarks about the earth as a sculpture, and how any addition to the ground, any scratch, any trace, extends the sculpture, earth, through and into other meanings. And so I guess I was interested in these new traces that what we've done this morning leaves behind. And I don't know if that is to be understood in the footsteps or in the process of Caroline as she walks this perimeter, or if it's to be understood in the process of internalization as she internalizes the role of the guard, and that transforms perhaps her relationship to self and other and university and neighborhood. But I guess I'm interested in, like, what are these traces that this leaves behind? And what new meanings do they bring to bear upon both Dennis Oppenheim's 1970 conceptual performance, but also our relationship to Philadelphia in 2016?
By the end of the 45 minutes, I noticed that I could see where I had been walking in the grass, like the grass had been trampled down noticeably on the path that I had walked a number of times. And so I sort of tried to follow that path.
And how about, like, your body? Do you feel like your body was registering, to go back to, again, earlier conversations, this pattern, this movement? Like, was it becoming root or routine or habit or almost unconscious?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I had, like, landmarks for where I turned and what paths to follow. Like, I would walk towards a tree or around a specific piece of trash on the ground or something. At the beginning, I was trying to, as I walked the different lines that represented different streets, I was trying to envision those streets in my head and think about the places that we were representing. But I found myself sort of losing track of place and becoming more focused on what I was guarding. And when people
meaning the neighborhood or meaning this supposedly barren
land? Yeah, this park, I guess. Uh-huh. I started feeling like responsibility for people who walked through the park.
To respect it, to value it.
Yeah, like I would keep an eye on them, make sure they weren't doing anything. And it's not really like there was anything for them to do, but I felt some sort of responsibility towards them. Also the pigeons, oddly. There were a number of birds in the park, and I found myself, like, watching them, trying to figure out.
It's very interesting, right? This internalization almost of a power dynamic, right? And this, you start to reproduce this power dynamic. And, of course, the uniform is a fake one.
Yeah.
But regardless of that, conscious as you may be of that, the rapidity with which this routinized movement pattern encourages you to start to surveillance, right, and demarcate questions of value, ownership, you know, protection.
And I think the reading is so much different when you think about Caroline's role as a guard versus her role as a student, because when she's taking on the role of the guard and walking around this park, she's taking ownership of the land, whereas if you just saw her as a student walking through this park, the land almost has ownership over her, and she's just leaving her mark on it.
It seemed like a theater play that there was rewritten, the roles were set, and the people were just like fitting into all the positioning in a very natural, almost unconscious way. While you wear the uniform, you become the guard, and also the people are being guarded, although it is just a performative action. It is a fascinating moment.
I think probably the most uncomfortable moment for me of the whole process is when we met the other students in the class and a number of other people at the park, and then we were like, it's time to start, and I had to switch from my role as a student and as just myself interacting with other people, and then go into the role of the guard and begin walking the path and composing myself as a guard instead of as a student.
I wanted to maybe propose one more kind of question to all of us.
We have another student.
Yeah, you can join. So I want to propose one more question, which is something concerning, again, maybe it comes back to something we've been talking about, but the non-climactic nature of this morning. I mean, Amy, you and I were the only ones who were in New Orleans. But in New Orleans, there was something very complicated, right, at stake, right? There was the sense that the work was being co-opted or appropriated. That the work was being transformed. In this case, we've taken profound liberties, but rather than there seeming to be some scene of tension or conflict, it seemed just the opposite, almost non-climactic, And I don't know if my thoughts here are entirely clear, but I don't know if you wanted to speak to that, if that was your experience. Was this experience as emotionally fraught as New Orleans? And if not, what was your emotional experience?
Yeah. Well, in a way, the big excitement, the tension this morning was whether a chain-link fence that was around the perimeter was going to be removed. Mm-hmm. I guess it had been there since the night before, and there was a sign on it, so I guess they started to remove it last night. It was only this morning, so that's another area that we, I think, might diverge the project into, the kind of the various ways of guarding in terms of physical structures and so on. But eventually, yes, they did remove the fence. There in New Orleans, they positioned signs.
That functioned as fence.
They had several staff members. It was almost Broadway compared to off. In terms of the kind of the situation of theatricality that they kind of brought to it.
Right.
Right, so, Carolyn?
Yeah, I thought it was sort of ironic that the fence that was up around the 40th Street Park had a sign on it that said rent a guard.
Yeah.
And obviously, like, a fence is not, I don't know, not maybe necessarily what we think of as a guard, but is in a way.
Right, so in a way there was, it was intentional on our part, but in a way we diverged profoundly from what Dennis Oppenheim did in 1970 in that we chose sites that are perpetually being guarded. And as you guys were just talking about, yesterday the whole area was fenced off to supposedly protect the students that were going to be situated within from those without. Right, and so this is an area that's so overdetermined by guarding that our guarding in a way is almost all too easy to not pay attention to ignore. It just seems a natural condition, right? Whereas in South Central Wisconsin or in adjacent to New Orleans Museum of Art, it's an artificial kind of activity or gesture. Yeah.
Well, yes, but I mean, in terms of an artwork per se, they're equally valid sort of aesthetic positions. You can have something bright orange against a landscape, or you can have something that's painted to look like a tree. And, you know, depending on what your objective is, you're either successful in communicating your idea or not. So in terms of an artwork, don't you think you could say that this is a valid approach also?
No, I think so. But as you said before, maybe it also signals how much things have changed and how much the landscapes in Philadelphia that many of us are moving through are so different than the way that... so different than the spatial politics of 1970 in the particular cases and situations where Dennis was working.
And yeah.
Working. Yeah.
But I think he did... You know, he was working also at workshops there, so the... involving his students, I think, was parallel.
Well, it may also call into question the validity of a human guard in today's age, and how all the students on campus today interact with the electric pin pads to access the rooms, and fences are commonplace in daily life, and sort of taking... we actually place most of the human guards on the very edge, out of sight, and they're sort of the frontier, and then we slowly build up barriers instead. And so,
you mean so like guarding, like embodied acts of guarding, you know, it seems kind of archaic,
yeah.
Or romantic in 2016. Asaf, were you going to say something about that?
Yeah, I think like I'm very interested in the like non-climatic, this kind of like non-moment, because it means it works straight to the convention. And I think this is like the convention is in a way that has the political potential. That's like documentary photography, there's like the first frame, but the second frame is always the one that shows like the deeper cultural political currents. And I think, I don't know, maybe it's a little bit dramatic, but like the horror is in the everyday. It's not in the singular event. And I think in that sense, it points out to the everyday, and in that sense, I think it has a lot of political value.
Mm-hmm. It signals or signifies how accepted guarding has become, and how ubiquitous and universal it has become, and how much it structures so much of our lives, whether we're on a university campus or not, right? Whether we're moving through a mall or a bank or a civic space or any urban space in a way.
And in that sense it's a very dramatic statement.
Right.
The way we excel, we internalize it also, she's just doing her job, so everybody's just going to do their business, and we're just like, now being guarded. Oh, not yet.
Right. But that there's actually extraordinary things at stake in this seemingly banal, everyday act of guarding. That's what you're saying, right?
But we internalize it in that way.
And that, in a way, this is perhaps most legible in the very way that the word barren is understood today, and that's analogous maybe to the way it was functioning in Dennis's work, where, in a way, neighborhoods are considered to be barren. All sorts of land masses and spaces are considered to be barren, but in fact they're full of people. But we're not cognizant of that, right? We're so acclimated to guarding that we're not always attentive to the politics of guarding and to the problematics of who we guard and how we guard and what we guard.
Or should accept guarding as citizens.
That it's even acceptable in the first place is something that we don't even think about. Yeah, we wonder who we're guarding or what we're guarding, but guarding seems to just be totally acceptable. We would never question guarding itself. We would question maybe the performative dimension, right?
Yeah, I was struck when I was taking these walks with the walking guards what their authority was, because they didn't carry guns. They couldn't arrest people. They didn't have handcuffs or anything.
They're not even necessarily guards. They're more like escorts.
Right. Mm-hmm. They're hired by a company that does guarding. But, like, what is their authority? What power do they have in these neighborhoods? Can they really do anything? Are they actually keeping us safer?
But it's more like a psychological support.
Yeah.
Right? So that you don't feel that you're alone.
It's also a psychological deterrent. Just because by wearing a uniform, it sort of claims to be a security company or a guarding, it projects the ability to punish, even if that individual doesn't actually possess it.
Right. They seemingly represent some authority, some institutional or civic or governmental power, right? And the uniform signals that. I mean, it calls to mind this work of Oppenheim's that Amy and I have spent a great deal of time thinking about over the years, protection, which raises the question of why we always feel that we need to be protected, and how protection attributes so much value. But there's also here like a politics of fear, right? The you need that guard or that escort to protect you from something. You may not have actually needed any protection in the first place. There may be no rational basis for that fear in the first place, but somehow the presence of the guard legitimates the fear and legitimates the need for the guard, and it becomes a cycle that repeats and magnifies the fear that motivated this in the first place. But that fear is a social construction, right?
Yeah, I felt almost guilty calling guards a number of times because I felt like I wasn't going to neighborhoods where I felt unsafe, or I wasn't going to neighborhoods where I felt I should feel unsafe.
But then the guard is in a way in kind of encouraging you, not intentionally, but kind of almost unconsciously, they're encouraging you to think that you need the guard.
Yeah.
to move through.
It encourages the members of the inhabitants of that neighborhood to feel like as though they are threatening or like unwanted.
So the guard constructs, and you, being in your capacity as the one who, is called the guard, is accompanied by the guard. In a way, the guard is constructing a border. You're constructing a border where there may not have been one,
mm-hmm.
Which the guard is then needed to trespass or to cross.
Right, and then the edge of where these University City District guards will take you is Wallace Street, and it seems so random to me. Like, why Wallace Street? Why this area? What's further and what's I don't know.
Mm. And then there's this racial dimension, which is incredibly complicated to unpack, right? You're being encouraged to call and rely on the guard when you move into a neighborhood that's racially black, right?
Well, and all of the guards are black.
Right.
All of the guards that I had, at least.
Right. Which invites all these complicated analyses of kind of, the fear of an institution that's predominantly white, of neighborhoods that are predominantly black.
Right.
But also this notion that the only way to be protected is to somehow rely on somebody who's black. So there's this very stereotypical, reductive logic here that reduces neighborhoods to skin colors and guards to their skin color. Right? Like, we're not talking about people. Like, we've abstracted altogether from the very beginning from any individuality, any potential to think in terms of individuals. And maybe that's a consequence of the act of guarding or the guard themselves.
And just going back briefly to this idea of the act being anticlimactic, in that way it was sort of like a happening in the sense that it was art as everyday life. And I agree with, in the sense that that's almost a more powerful, or at least a very powerful statement, the fact that this piece of art that is so should be so on the edge, what was once avant-garde, is now taken as commonplace, and how that should cause people to call into question what they've accepted.